Welcome to the Mercy Hill Church podcast. This podcast is a collection of sermons and conversations intended to stir up your affections for Jesus. We hope this content helps you know and tell the story of Jesus better.
Well, you guys doing okay this morning?
Yeah.
Everybody good? Good, good. Look, if you got a Bible, you can turn to 1 Kings chapter 18. 1 Kings is in the Old Testament. Here at Mercy Hill, we just want you to feel comfortable navigating the scripture so there's no shame in having to go to the table of contents and tracking that thing down. It can be a little complicated to find. 1 Kings chapter 18. So there's something you should probably know about the Nichols family is when it comes to Georgia football, we don't do well with competing devotions. We have one allegiance and one allegiance only, and that is to the Georgia Bulldogs. Now, amen. Now, what you should know is I grew up in the home of two Georgia Bulldogs. My wife, Kristen, and I both attended the University of Georgia. And so I am constantly confused by friends and neighbors who will say things to me like, oh, yeah, I'll cheer for the Bulldogs if they're on. I'm like, what? Or I have a neighbor who's like, oh, I'm a Georgia Tech fan, but I cheer for Georgia, too. I'm like, I just want to be super clear, man. I don't ever cheer for Tech. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know what that's like. I don't know what that's about. I'm constantly confused by people who have picked their teams. I don't know what that's about. I was raised to be a Georgia Bulldog. I have no idea how to pick a team to be a fan of. We don't do well with competing allegiances or devotion. And some of you might think that it's just me, but that's not true. It's Kristen, too. She doesn't mess around. Several years ago, when I was still working at a Central Baptist in Warner Robins, I was a student pastor. Our kids, Hudson was playing upward soccer, and Kristen and I were coaching his team together. And the colors that year were white and Tennessee orange. And the rec director of that church handed us our coaches' shirts, and my wife said, I'm not going to wear this. We don't have anything to do with the University of Tennessee and our family. I'm not going to wear this. And he thought she was joking. Sure enough, first soccer game of the season, I show up trying to be a good team player, wearing my orange and white, terrible colored coach's shirt. Kristen's wearing last year's coach's shirt. You know what I mean? She's like, no, not doing it. Because we do not do competing allegiances or devotions. Unfortunately, football is easy. Right? It's easy to be devoted and to reject all other competition, but in our everyday lives, it's a little more difficult. We often have other things that are competing for our attention, our devotion, our hearts, and our allegiances. And what we're going to see today in 1 Kings chapter 18 is competing allegiances or devotions having what is an epic, unbelievable showdown between a guy named Elijah and the prophets of this God named Baal. 1 Kings chapter 18. I need to set it up, the setting for you before we get there. At this point in the story, for those of you who've been following along through 1 Kings, the people of God have been divided into two kingdoms with two different kings. Israel's the northern kingdom. Their capital is Samaria. It's 10 tribes of the original 12 are a part of Israel. The southern kingdom is Judah. It's Judah plus what's left over from the tribe of Benjamin. That capital is Jerusalem. And there's a king that rises to power in Israel. So in the northern kingdom, his name is Ahab. And Ahab is an epically, notoriously bad dude. In fact, what we know about him before we even meet him officially, in 1 Kings chapter 16, it just says that Ahab did evil in the sight of the Lord more than all who were before him. So if you've ever read through like the Old Testament before, you met some of these kings that are terrible, here is the worst of the worst. In part because he's just a bad dude. Also, in particular, Ahab has established the worship inside Israel of this pagan god named Baal. It's become common practice. Now, Baal is a Canaanite god of fertility and the weather. And so, like any good king, he wants what? More citizens of the kingdom, and he wants some good weather so they grow some great crops and can make a lot of money off of those. And so he has adopted this practice for the good of his own kingdom. There's also another character in 1 Kings 18 that you need to know. His name is Elijah. Elijah is a prophet of God who has boldly spoken on God's behalf to God's people. And he has spoken actually publicly against Ahab. And so these guys do not like each other, to say the least. In fact, Ahab has spent a considerable amount of time before we get to chapter 18 trying to search Elijah down so that he can kill him. There's currently a drought in the land, 3 years without rain. And God sends Elijah back to talk to Ahab to tell him, hey, good news, rain is coming. So you can imagine there's already a lot of tenseness in this conflict when these guys get together. So Elijah shows up and he says, here's what we're going to do. Rain's going to come, but before we get to the rain, here's Ahab, what I need you to do. I need you to assemble all 450 of the prophets of Baal, the men who speak on behalf of this god Baal. And I'm going to come just me by myself, and I'm going to represent God, the Lord, Yahweh, the Lord of all. And we're going to meet together and settle this dispute. So chapter 18, 1 Kings chapter 18, verse 20 is where we pick up in the story. So Ahab sent to all the people of Israel and gathered the prophets together at Mount Carmel. And Elijah came near to all the people and said, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him. But if Baal, then follow him. And the people did not answer him a word. So before this showdown even starts, Elijah gives the people a chance to respond. He says, how long are you going to go limping between these two different gods? That word literally means limping, but it carries this idea of hesitating or wavering between, we would say it this way, how long are you going to continue to be on the fence? Unwilling to make a decision about which God you want to give your full allegiance to, how long are you going to go back and forth? And the people don't respond. They don't say a word. So verse 22. So then Elijah said to the people, I only am left a prophet of the Lord, but Baal's prophets are 450 men. Let two bulls be given to us and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut it into pieces and lay it on the wood and put no fire on. And I will prepare the other bull and I will lay it on the wood and put no fire on. And you shall call the name of your little g God, and I will call upon the name of the Lord, that's Yahweh, and the God who answers by fire, he is God. And all the people answered, it is well spoken. So here's then the scene. You're going to set up two altars, two bulls, two groups of people. On one side, 450 prophets of Baal with their bull and their altar. On the other side, Elijah with a bull and an altar. And each side is going to pray and ask their God to answer with fire. And Elijah says, we'll know the truth when we leave here today. Whichever God answers his people and consumes the offering with fire, that'll be the God that we all should worship. So the prophets of Baal go first, verse 26. They took the bull that was given to them and they prepared it and they called upon the name of Baal from morning until noon, saying, oh, Baal, please answer us. But there was no voice and no one answered. And they limped around the altar that they had made all morning. They're calling out, no voice, no answer, no fire. And they limped, he says, again, another play on words, meaning they are doing some sort of ritualistic dance that looks like hesitating or wavering kind of around their altar, begging Baal to answer and still no answer. So at noon, I love Elijah for this. This feels like very on point for me. Noon, verse 27 says, Elijah mocked them, saying, cry aloud, for he is a god. Either he is musing, or he is relieving himself, or maybe he is on a journey, or perhaps he is asleep and must be awakened. I love this. He just says, hey, I know. Maybe he's preoccupied. Maybe yell louder so he can hear you. Maybe he's in the restroom. Maybe you need to yell louder. He can't hear you because he's in the restroom. Maybe he just took a trip. He's not paying attention to you. He's on a journey somewhere. Maybe he's asleep and you have to wake him up. So continue, keep yelling. Verse 28, they crowd aloud and cut themselves after their custom with swords and lances until the blood gushed out upon them. And as midday passed, they raved on until the time of the offering of the oblation. But there was no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. So they double down, they cut themselves, they continue to rant and rave, and yet there's no answer. No one's paying attention to what's going on with these prophets of Baal. So then it's Elijah's turn. He calls the people over. He carefully rebuilds the altar of the Lord. He takes 12 stones representing a stone from each tribe, each people of Israel. And then he curiously digs a trench all the way around his altar. Then puts wood on it, prepares the bull, lays it on the wood. And then he tells the people, he's like, hey, I need some help. You guys go get water and pour it over the bull and the wood. And they do that. And he's like, let's do it again. Three times he does it until water fills up the trench that he's dug around the altar. And then verse 36, at the time of the offering of the oblation, Elijah the prophet came near and said, O Lord, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, let it be known this day that you are God in Israel and that I am your servant, and that I have done these things at your word. Answer me, O Lord, answer me, that these people may know that you, O Lord, are God, and that you have turned their hearts back. No ranting, no raving, no limping, no dancing, no cutting, no bleeding. Elijah just offers a simple prayer. He says, God, would you answer? Would you prove and show today that you are the Lord Most High, that you're the one true God? And would you answer and would you show that you are still at work to turn these people's hearts back to you? Can you imagine? A people who have abandoned the Lord, who have given their devotion and allegiance to Baal, who are wavering in their devotion on the fence. And Elijah still prays for them. Would you let them know that you're a God that longs for their hearts to return to you, that you still want their devotion? You have not written them off. Verse 38. Then the fire of the Lord fell and consumed the burnt offering and the wood and the stones and the dust and licked up the water that was in the trench. And when all the people saw it, they fell on their faces and said, the Lord, that means Yahweh, he is God. The Lord, Yahweh, he is God. And Elijah said to them, seize the prophets of Baal, let not one of them escape. And they seized them, and Elijah brought them down to the brook of Kishon and slaughtered them there. So the Lord answers with fire. Could you imagine the scene? I imagine it like this. Have you ever been to a concert when the pyrotechnics like fly up out of the stage, right? And everybody's like, yeah, right? You remember that moment? That's kind of what I think. Fire falls from heaven, consumes everything, and everybody is so in awe. They're like, yeah, Dex, help me out, man, right? Yeah. I don't know if you guys know my buddy Dex down here, but he loves preaching, and I love that he loves preaching, and he gets into it, right? He's helping me out. They all scream, and then they realize what just happened. You ever had one of those moments that seems exciting until you realize the gravity of what just happened? That the Lord of the entire universe sent fire from heaven that not only consumed the bull and the wood, but the stones and the dust and the water. So in the middle of they're like, yeah, they go, oh no, right? I could be next. And they fall on their faces and declare allegiance to the Lord. You go, great, Brandon, that's a crazy story. I have never seen this happen before. I've seen some crazy stuff. I've been in the Target parking lot of Barrett Parkway. That place seems wild. You know what I mean? Like, but I've never seen anything like this. What does this have to do with me? We don't live in a society with fabricated idols of stone or wood or precious metals. We don't worship Baal here. But the truth is that an idol doesn't have to be a physical statue made of stone. It doesn't have to be a pagan god like Baal. In fact, check this out. In Ezekiel chapter 14, verse 1, Prophet Ezekiel records God's words to the leaders at this time of Israel. Here's what he says. Then certain of the elders of Israel came to me and sat before me, and the word of the Lord came to me. And this is what the Lord spoke to Ezekiel, son of man. These men have taken their idols into their hearts and set the stumbling block of their iniquity before their faces. And the reality is what's true of those people that Ezekiel's talking to can also be true of us. Not that we have idols of stone or metal, not that we have little sanctuaries set up in our homes where we bow down to them, but that we have idols that dwell in our hearts. Things that we are devoted to, that we cast our allegiance upon, that become ultimate in our lives. You see, the pagans who worshiped idols were just more honest than us. That's all it is. They really want a good harvest, so they pray to the God of the harvest. You and I just aren't honest enough to say out loud that we want a lot more money and we are willing to sacrifice to get it. They're just more honest than us. And so we can have these idols in our hearts. Idolatry wasn't limited for these people just to the worship of statues or false god. It has to do with their decisions, their thoughts, their affections, and the objects of their devotion. Tim Keller says it this way: what is an idol? It is anything more important to you than God. Anything that absorbs your heart and imagination more than God. Anything you seek to give you what only God can give. When we value anything over God, then that is idolatry. No matter what the worship practice behind it looks like. The worship practice could be gathering around the altar and slaughtering a bull. Or it could be incessantly scrolling through Instagram hoping somebody liked our post. The worship of an idol could be bowing down, prostrate before a metal god, or it could be. It could be what we do at work to maximize profits that maybe is on the margin of right or wrong. Whatever is ultimate in our lives. The reality is, most of the time, idols are good things. Most often, idols are good things that we exalt to be ultimate things. We find that something is good. It's a good gift from God. And what we do as people is we make it the most important thing, the thing of highest value in our lives. Physical health is a good thing. Your body is a good gift from God. It's good to be in shape. It's good to work out. It's good to eat right. But that could be something that becomes an idol in all of our lives. When it absorbs our heart, when it's ultimate in our devotion, when we ignore others to make sure that we can exercise like right, you know, on our schedule or according to whatever, when it takes over our thoughts or imaginations, when it becomes all that we think about, when we get on Instagram to make sure that our body is measuring up to someone else's unreal, faked body, right? Like, it can take over and become ultimate, even a good thing. There's all sorts of examples. There are personal idols, like romantic love. Our families can be an idol. Money, power, achievement, social access, emotional dependence, health, fitness, physical beauty, all can be idols. None of those things in and of themselves are necessarily bad, but can easily take over, demand our full devotion and allegiance, become ultimate. They're cultural idols, military power, technological advancements, economic prosperity. In more traditional cultures unlike ours, it could be family, hard work, duty, or moral virtue. Note Western culture, it's individual freedom, self-discovery, personal affluence, and fulfillment. All of those things can take over as idols. We can have intellectual idols. Ideologies that we buy into, there's some obvious ones that are wrong on the surface, right? Racism, sexism. But there's one a little more insidious in American culture right now, which is what? It's education. We actually believe that if we just give someone more information, they'll become a better person. And we can pursue that at all ends. Political systems could be an idol. Guys, I love democracy. It is a wonderful system of government that affords me unbelievable freedom in my personal life. It also can become an idol where we exalt that political system over God. John Calvin says, man's nature, so to speak, is a perpetual forge of idols. Here's what he means. In your life, in my life, our hearts never-endingly manufacture idolatry. That nearly every good gift in our lives that we enjoy can be an idol, and we all have the tendency to make it that. There's no end to what you or I will make ultimate in our lives. Well, what's the problem? See a couple things in the text. The first thing is our idols divide our devotion. I love this verse 21 when Elijah comes near to the people, says, how long will you go limping between two different opinions? You see, it's not that the people of Israel ceased to worship God. They still worship God. They still refer to themselves as the people of God. But yet they had added the worship of Baal on top of it. They had merged another belief system with following God. And we fall into that temptation all the time, wavering between two worlds. Man, it's not that we stopped showing up at church. It's not that we renounced our faith. It's not that we deleted the phrase follower of Jesus from our Twitter bio. But we do likewise waver or limp or sit on the fence. I mean, we go to church on Sunday and we worship the Lord, but Monday through Friday, money or success or achievement takes over. Often, we have a very healthy tradition in the United States of loving our country, patriotism, and also loving the Lord. But if we're not careful, our love of country, likewise, Monday through Friday, Saturday, can take over a place of devotion. And we start to think that it's America first and God on the side. Look, I love you very much. Please take this the way it's intended. If Fox News shapes your worldview more than open Bible and prayer, that might be an issue. If CNN shapes your views more than what God says in His Word, that might be an issue, and what you may have identified is a wavering between two options. You want to know why so-called prosperity gospel is so prevalent in the United States? Because it exposes our real God. We want God to help us be rich. Because we actually value prosperity more than anything else. Or maybe the cultural idol will be this, that prosperity will make me happy. And we believe it. And we waver between these two different devotions. The problem is partial devotion isn't devotion. What would you think of me this morning if I said, I am faithful to my wife, Kristen, 68% of the time? I'm dedicated to my job 4 out of 5 days a week. Don't worry, Mercy Hill. I write my own sermons most of the time. But occasionally I download those jokers off the internet because, I mean, who wants to put 45 hours a week into work in here? I need a break every now and then. Is that dedication? Is that devotion? To be a devoted husband, you're faithful 100% of the time. Devoted husbands do not have Bumble accounts, right? To be a devoted employee, you show up at work and work hard every day. That's what it looks like. And also to be devoted to the Lord means that we are devoted 100%. I'm not saying perfect. But God has our full allegiance. That's what Elijah says to the people. He says, you got to choose. At least be honest about what's going on here. If Yahweh is God, then you follow him. If not, then follow something else. But the half-hearted thing isn't going to work. The second issue that we see in the text is not only do our idols divide our devotion, but our idols fail to deliver. I think it's the most striking point of this passage to me in verse 26. Prepare the altar, prophets of Baal, they're calling out all the way, all morning until noon. And then the writer of 1 Kings helps us to see what happened. There's no voice, verse 26, and no one answered. No answer. They limped around, right? The altar, still no answer. Verse 29, they go past noon, raving on and on and on. And what? There is no voice. No one answered. No one paid attention. The writer wants you and I to know that the idol of Baal in this particular story didn't answer, couldn't answer, didn't speak, couldn't deliver. And what I want you to know this morning is the idols of your heart and my heart will fail us as well. The stock market crashes. Our spouses won't be able to measure up to this perfect, idolized version of a spouse that we have. Our kids are going to grow up and move out. Republicans are going to do something very un-Republican, and Democrats are going to do something very un-Democrat. Like, maybe we see that right now. But even more than that for us, good things just can't be ultimate things. You ever need a stepladder and not have one? I've done this several times. I always make this mistake. It's really dumb, and I still do it. Need a stepladder? I don't have one, but you know what I do have? I got some Rubbermaid tubs. You know what I mean? That's a good step height. Made out of plastic, right? You stack that thing up. You take a step on there, right? And you got to be real careful. You got to get one foot on one edge and the other foot on the other edge. Because if you stand in the middle, that top's just going to collapse, right? And then you're like doing this, like trying to reach the really high thing with your brilliant plan. The idols in our lives are like those Rubbermaid containers. They are awesome when used according to their purpose. I love those containers to store stuff, put it up on the top shelf of the garage, right? Perfect. Money is great when it is a tool that you use to provide for your family and to be a blessing to those around you. It's amazing. Your physical health is an unbelievable gift, right? When you use it to show up and be present in people's lives, to play with your kids, to have fun with friends, unbelievable. But just like a Rubbermaid container, none of those things are designed to hold the weight of God's status. So they will always fail. But I love in the text just one more thing. There is a God who answers. In this text, while the idol fails to answer, there is a God who does answer. And this God answers powerfully with fire raining down from heaven, consuming this complete altar. You go, Brandon, that's great. That's amazing that happened to Elijah, but like, man, it happened to me, right? I haven't seen anything like that. But in the New Testament, we also find the God who answers. That the God who sent fire also sent his son, Jesus, who showed up and lived the life that you and I were supposed to live, who taught the very words of God to people, who showed up out of love, compassion, grace, and mercy to lay down his life on the cross for us in our place, and who, according to over 500 witnesses, rose from the dead. I don't know about you, that sounds more impressive to me than fire from heaven. Let me repeat the story. God showed up in person, laid down his life in your place for you on the cross, and rose from the dead, never to die again. See, you and I have a God Who answers? Who answered Jesus' life, death, and resurrection? And so what do we do? What do we do? Two practical steps this morning, quickly. The first step is you and I have to identify our idols. We have to do the work of looking at our own hearts and seeing what has captured our attention or our devotion or our allegiance. Could ask some questions to help diagnose that. What captures your imagination? What do you think about when you got downtime? What do you think about when you're not on your phone? Which is for some of you like 14 minutes a day. I know that, right? What captures your imagination? It might be a clue of something that is an idol in your life. How do you spend your money? It's a good clue. A good question to ask. Am I spending out of balance amount of money on a particular thing? What do I consistently give my cash to? How do you respond to unanswered prayers or frustrated hopes? And is there an arena where those come up all the time? Are you constantly frustrated that your kids aren't measuring up to what you thought they were going to be? And there might be an idol below the surface where you believe your own identity is based on what your kids accomplish. Where are your frustrated hopes? What elicits an emotional response from you? Where do you get the most angry? Where do you get the most sad? Those can help us identify our idols. But then after we identify them, we have to replace them. Replacing an idol is a two-step process. We replace idols by repenting and rejoicing. Repenting is when we acknowledge that we're not trusting God and we repent or turn from the thing that we are trusting to trust God again. The practice of repenting reminds us of how we rightly treasure God above all. Then when we see an idol, we lay it down. We walk away from it. We don't continue to waver, but we turn from that thing and trust Christ again. Then we, in our minds, go, this is not a thing that I want to give devotion or allegiance to. Now remember what Calvin said. Our hearts are perpetual idol factories. So this is not a one-time practice. This is constant. Evaluating, identifying. When we identify and we respond in repentance. But there's a second step, which is rejoicing. You're like, rejoicing? Well, yeah. The step is not, I want to be super clear this morning, the step is not beating yourself up. Man, I did that thing again. I trusted an idol again. I'm a terrible person. The step is not wallowing in shame or guilt. Those things are powerless to defeat the idols in your heart and my heart. Powerless. There's only one thing that has the power to defeat idols in your life and my life. And that thing is the full, joyful, exuberant exaltation of the one true God. The worship of God. The glad adoration of who He is, the rejoicing in His goodness and His grace, the seeing Him better so we can exalt Him better. The practice of rejoicing reminds us of why we treasure what we treasure. That we are making much of God, rejoicing in His goodness, His grace, His compassion, and His mercy. Idolatry is an act of worship, and if you want to find your way out of the worship of money, you have to worship something better. Idolatry is an act of worship, and if you want to find your way out of worshiping achievement or success, you have to worship something better. So the means out of idolatry is rejoicing. I do have something better. You guys know I'm a Braves fan. When the Braves are struggling right now, right? Lost 7 out of 10. They look hopeless at the plate. It is hard to watch. Not as hard as when I was growing up watching the Braves, right? The 80s until 91, it was miserable. And I constantly had to remind myself, no, this is a good team to cheer for. What happens though? Feeling down about the Braves? You've been listening to too much talk radio, reading too much stuff online, feeling pessimistic about the Braves. Maybe this isn't even a team you want to cheer for anymore, right? And then you go to the stadium and you see Tom Glavine's retired number. Or maybe this is just me, and that automatically reminds me of 1991, worst to first, when I was 11 years old, right? And watching the Braves have a magical season. You see all the pennants up and down, right? In right field. And you go, oh, no, this has been a successful franchise. They are worthy of my fandom. You sit in the stadium, you hear everybody else cheering for the Braves. Tomahawk chop starts going, and you're like, yeah, I am here rejoicing. Cheering for my team, the Braves. Look around the crowd. Everybody's wearing Acuna jerseys or Albies jerseys or Riley's jerseys or some throwback Dale Murphy jerseys, occasionally a Phil Negro jersey. And you're like, yeah, this is my team. I'm so glad I'm here exulting in the Braves. And it starts to replace those other thoughts or fears, negativity around the team. So the way out of that is rejoicing. And here's the same thing, your life and my life. The way out of our idolatry is to identify it, turn from it, and then rejoice in the God who is worthy of all praise. If you're struggling with that, here's the place to go. Romans 5:8. Okay. Demonstrated his love for us in this, that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. I don't have another idol in my life that out of full love laid down his life for me on the cross. Not a single one. Stack of bills. Never died for me in my place, right? Achievement never died for me in my place. Romantic love never died for me in my place. Capitalism never died for me in my place. Democracy never died for me in my place. There's no Republican who died for me in my place. No Democrat who died for me in my place. Nobody on Fox News died for me in my place. Nobody on CNN died for me in my place. Just Jesus and Jesus alone. And when you start to think about that, rejoicing, glorying in, being in awe of that, then you and I will fall on our faces for a much different reason than the people of Israel before the fire from heaven. We will fall on our faces in glad joy because we have a God who loves us so unbelievably well. Demonstrated by Jesus on the cross.
Thanks for listening to the Mercy Hill Church podcast. To keep up with the life of Mercy Hill Church, follow us on Facebook and Instagram. We believe the Christian life is best experienced in community. If you're in our area, we'd love for you to join us. If not, we'd love to help you get plugged into a local church near you. Have a great week.